Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
On the evening of May the 14th, 1921, police in various stations across London began to receive reports of strange activity. It started when four men knocked on the door of a house at Stow Road in Shepherd's Bush, demanding to see a certain Mr. Berthright. When they were informed he wasn't at home, they forced their way inside the house and started a fire in an effort to burn the building down. They then moved on to the McNeil House, a few streets away on Bloemfontein Road. When they knocked on the door, it was Mrs. McNeil who answered. On this occasion, they asked to see her son-in-law, Charles Corm. Informed he too was not at home, they again forced their way into the house, where they were confronted by the woman's husband, Horace. A tussle broke out, a shot was fired, and Horace McNeil fell back as the men fled the scene. The wounded 47-year-old was taken to the West London Hospital, where he died a few days later. Throughout that evening, further reports registered similar incidents. In the London suburbs of West Kensington, Battersea, Catford, Greenwich and Tooting, there were further attacks, with two more people sustaining minor gunshot wounds. Although spread across considerable distances, it didn't take the police long to establish a common motive and link the incidents. In all cases, the attackers had been looking for current or former members of the Royal Irish Constabulary. The attacks had been carried out by the IRA. However, the volunteers involved had not travelled from Ireland. These IRA volunteers were members of the Irish community in Britain, some of whom had been born in Ireland. Others, however, were second generation, born to Irish parents in England. In this episode, I interview Sam McGrath, who will be taking us on a fascinating journey back to Britain and England in particular, to look at the crucial role played by the Irish Republican movement there during the War of Independence. One that's often written out of history. As we're about to hear, their experiences of the conflict were very different and often much more difficult than that of Republicans back in Ireland. Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer and this is the War of Independence, Part 16, the IRA campaign in Britain. This episode is based around an interview with Sam McGrath, who, as you will be aware, has been a researcher on the wider series on the War of Independence. Now, Sam has carried out extensive research into the IRA in England, and Manchester in particular, so he has great insights into this often overlooked aspect of the conflict. Now, before we start the show, I want to give you a sense of where this episode, though, fits into the series as a whole, and where we're going in the coming weeks. So this podcast and the last two episodes have diverged from the chronological pattern of the story. The topics such as this one on the IRA in Britain don't really fit into any one point in the story, so they did require standalone episodes. However, in the next show, the series will return to a chronological structure as the war enters its most bitter phase. We'll begin this in Dublin in later 1920 by looking at the events known as Bloody Sunday. That might yet actually become two episodes. Then in what is now episode 18, but could be episode 19, we're going to head to West Cork and join an IRA unit on the Macroom to Dunmanway Road at a place called Kilmichael for what would become a very famous ambush and pivotal moment in the War of Independence. Now, while all that's coming down the line, Next week, there's no War of Independence episode in the main feed, but on Sunday, that's October the 10th at 4 p.m. Irish time, there is an exclusive Q&A with Dr. Brian Hanley from the History Department of Trinity College Dublin for supporters of the show. The Q&A will be on how the War of Independence is remembered in Ireland today. Now, this is fast becoming a fascinating but very controversial topic. The latest controversy saw the President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins, refuse to attend an event marking the centenary of Northern Ireland just a few weeks ago. Other contentious incidents included a planned commemoration of the Royal Irish Constabulary in 2020 that had to be cancelled. Now, these events have revealed just how tricky commemorations can be and asks the question of how history should be remembered and how we mark painful chapters in our past. Now, Brian has contributed to debates around this issue, so the Q&A will be a unique chance to get his expert opinion on this topic as we approach what is arguably the most contentious period in terms of commemorations, the Civil War. As I said, this is exclusively available to supporters of the show at patreon.com/Irish Podcast or Acast Plus. There's links in the show notes below, and when you sign up, you can get access to dozens of exclusive episodes and ad-free content, so it's really worth your while. Finally, don't forget to check out the new books, pins and flags at irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop. I'm only going to be able to avoid talking about it so long, but that certain time of the year where you need to buy presents for people is fast approaching, and the Irish History Podcast shop is a great place to get presents for people who are into history, who for some reason seem to be frequently the people who are hard to buy for. Anyway, check out the shop at irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop. Now to the show. Sound on today's episode was by Jason Looney. I began the interview with Sam by asking him to introduce himself. You've all heard his name throughout the series, but this is the man himself.
Yeah, hi everybody. My name is Sam McGrath. I've been working with Finn since the start of this podcast series as an extra help of hands in terms of research. I've been working as an archivist since graduating in 2013. And for the last 4 years, I've been working with the Military Service Pensions Collection, which is part of the military archives based in Cattlebrew Barracks in Dublin. I'm here in a personal capacity. My day-to-day job would be cataloguing and processing service pension applications from men and women who had claimed service between 1916 and 1923.
In order to understand the IRA, the Republican movement, and the War of Independence in Britain, we need to get a sense of the wider Irish community across the region. So Sam began by giving this overview of the Irish community in Britain in the 1920s.
In terms of, say, 1921, the total population of Britain was 40 million, roughly 40 million. The Irish-born population was just over 500,000. So quite substantial. And if you take a second generation and third generation Irish, you're talking about 2 million. So again, quite a number out of the total 40 million in England, Scotland and Wales. In terms of where they're based, it's many of the towns and cities that people today would associate with the Irish community. Obviously the capital, London, Liverpool City, and some of its kind of satellite towns like St. Helens and Earlstown. Manchester, another important place for the Irish community, and a neighbouring Salford City and Rochdale. Birmingham, and then also Scotland, and particularly Glasgow.
The story of the Republican movement in Britain is complex, and it varied between England, Scotland and Wales, and even between cities in each of these countries. So Sam concentrated on the story of the Republican movement in one city, that of Manchester, in the northeast of England. This gives us a much better sense of how the war played out and what it was like for one specific Irish community. As Sam now explains, the experience of the war in Manchester was shaped by a long history of radical activism among the Irish community in the city that stretched back to the early 19th century.
Yeah, so Manchester is a city which I've looked at particularly. I gave a talk just before COVID in Pier Street Library in Dublin about the Republican movement in Manchester. And I gave the same talk during COVID, actually, via Zoom to a Manchester Irish local history festival. So Manchester and London were the kind of two main places of interest for me in terms of research. And I'd be able to some degree, kind of look at the similarities and differences between the two cities. But talk about Manchester, you know, it has a very long and proud history of radical politics and political campaigns. And the Irish community have always been involved to various levels within those different political groups and campaigns, you know, going back as early as 1819 with the Peterloo Massacre, in which 18 people were killed during a rally, which was looking for, you know, basic parliamentary representation and basic kind of political reform. There's many Irish names in the list of those. During the middle part of the 1800s, when you have the Charterist campaign, again, people looking for quite basic social and political reform, there was Irish workers involved in all levels of that campaign. It's really 1867, really, with the Manchester Martyrs, where I guess the start of Irish Republican history in Manchester, that's certainly the focal point and the beginning. There was a failed uprising in 1867, a failed Fenian uprising. And two key figures managed to evade arrest afterwards, Thomas J. Kelly and Timothy Deasy. And on the 18th of September, 1867, these two prisoners are being transported in Gorton in southeast Manchester. And there's about 40 Fenians involved in a rescue campaign. And they attempt to essentially rescue these two Fenians from a prison van. So one policeman was killed in that operation. Three Irishmen, William O'Meara Allen, Michael Larkin and Michael O'Brien, were captured. They were convicted and hanged on the 23rd November 1867. So these three martyrs really become a focal point for, you know, everything from songs to poems to statues and annual commemorations, and both in Manchester and across Ireland. There's a further bombing campaign by Fenians in the 1880s, though Manchester itself, there doesn't seem to be any actual operations. It's London, Liverpool and Glasgow where those bombing attacks take place. As we come into the early 1900s, with a couple of kind of key moments in that timeline, James Connolly comes over to speak in Manchester and Salford in 1901-1902. The first branch of the Gaelic League is founded in 1904 in Manchester. And then the first Sinn Féin Cumann is founded in 1908. And then, like many other cities across England and Scotland, Irish volunteers organised their first companies in late 1913 in Manchester.
The 1916 Rising proved a pivotal moment for the Republican movement in Ireland. I was curious, though, what impact, if any, it had in Manchester.
Four Manchester-based Irish volunteers actually fight in the Rising, which is relatively a small number compared to those from Liverpool and London. I think in the immediate aftermath of the Rising, it really galvanises the Republican movement in Manchester. It particularly gives a sense of purpose to come on them on who begin to do large fundraising activity for the dependents of those who have been arrested and those who died. And they are also collecting food and they're bringing these and other provisions to the prisoners who at this stage are being held across different prisons in England and Wales. It seems to be only in Glasgow and Liverpool where there's Irish volunteer companies active post-1916. Manchester and other cities, there seems to be obviously a Republican movement, but it's not until maybe 1919 when you see new IRA companies formed.
Now, it was clear that women played a very important role in the Republican movement in Manchester in the aftermath of the Easter Rising. I asked Sam to explain a bit more about their activities in this crucial period leading up to the War of Independence.
They're doing fundraising, they're doing political work. I think the main activity of the Irish volunteers in Manchester after the 1916 Rising was arms smuggling, and the women played a very important role, particularly in terms of essentially bringing those arms on their person over from Manchester to Dublin. So yeah, women played a particularly important role, and the main branch of the first branch of Cumann na mBan was called St. Bridget's, and that was founded in 1916 in Manchester, and that eventually grows to a total of four branches during the War of Independence. But yeah, between 1916 and 1919, definitely the main role of the Republican movement in Manchester and other cities was arms smuggling.
Sam went on to explain the development of the IRA in the city.
Yeah, so the first company of the Manchester Battalion of the IRA is founded in 1919, and that's known as Number One Company. And I guess as you kind of go through 1919, their main day-to-day or week-to-week activity was drilling and organising work, and again, arms smuggling. The two major events that took place in 1919 from a Manchester point of view is the Lincoln Prison Escape, which occurred in February, and then later the Strangeways Prison Escape in October 1919.
I went on to ask Sam more about these escapes, but before we hear his answer, I'm delighted to announce that I have my first live show in Britain coming up in a few weeks. I'm really honoured to have been asked to participate in the Liverpool Irish Festival, and as part of the festival, I'm doing a live show in Grand Central in Liverpool on Sunday, October the 24th at 2 o'clock. Now, this is not Zoom links, I'll be there, so I'm really looking forward to the event and seeing lots of you there. Tickets are now available on the festival website. You'll find links in the show notes below. So hopefully I'll see you on October the 24th at 2 p.m. in Grand Central in Liverpool. Now back to the interview. Next, I asked Sam more about the pivotal prison escapes in 1919, which the Republican movement in Manchester were centrally involved in. Now, one of these escapes has already been covered in the series. That was Eamon de Valera's escape from Lincoln Jail in 1919. But Sam now explains some of the central characters in the Manchester Republican movement and their involvement in these escapes.
Yeah, so in terms of the Lincoln prison escape and Strangeways, I mean, they were essentially orchestrated by the Manchester IRA with obviously help from GHQ in Dublin. Some of the main individuals involved in the IRA in Manchester at that time were Patrick O'Donoghue, who was originally from Kerry. He was a grocer by trade, and he's based in Manchester by 1908. You know, one thing which I think is kind of interesting is looking at the ages of these people. You know, Patrick O'Donoghue, by the War of Independence, is in his early 30s. You know, he's experienced, he's respected. Again, another individual who would be a high-ranking IRA officer at the time is Liam McMahon. He's from Limerick originally. He's based in Manchester by 1909, and he's even older. He's in his early 40s by the time of the War of Independence. And both these men would have been quite close friends with Michael Collins, especially Donoghue, and they would have very close links with GHQ. Another individual which I think would be worth mentioning is Seamus Barrett, who was originally from Dublin, and he's active in politics in Manchester as far back as the early 1880s. So again, quite an interesting individual in terms of the continuation of Irish politics from 1880s right up to 1916 into the War of Independence and beyond. So definitely a huge degree of experience amongst the leading men of the Manchester IRA. But like, you know, most other companies in England and Ireland, the main bulk of the membership would be younger men in their earlier 20s, mainly.
One of the most important functions of the IRA in Britain was the procurement of weapons. Sam now explains where they got these weapons and how they were shipped to Ireland.
So certainly from post-1916 up to the War of Independence, there was arms smuggling, but it was reasonably on a small scale. The IRA were making contact with ex-British Army soldiers, mainly of Irish descent, who were coming back from places like France, who had their arms with them or either had access to arms. They were also getting in contact with serving British Army soldiers who were based in different barracks in Manchester. And they were also, you know, contacting pawn shops who might have had some arms for sale and commercial travellers. But it's really once the War of Independence starts in the start of 1919 that the arms smuggling really expands and develops to a larger scale. That's when the IRA actually start taking part in raids on various places where they think arms might be held. British Army huts, golf clubs is mentioned in the pension applications as the places where arms are kept, and also different scouting halls. The IRA also makes contacts in the railway amongst Irish workers there, and one particular pension applicant mentions that an Irish railway worker was able to steal arms that were en route to India. It's interesting in London that many IRA members looking back talk about the different criminal gangs which were active in London at the time and the contact the IRA were making with them. Dennis Carr mentions that he was in contact with the Titanic mob, who were based around Nile Street in Hoxton in London, and an Italian gang led by Darby Sabini, who were active in Clerkenwell. There's also talk of Russians and Arabs having guns. In comparison, there's no mention really of that in Manchester. As I said, it seems to be really raids on British Army huts and contacts with railway employees, which were the main source of arms in Manchester. Most of the arms that were being collected in Manchester, London, were then being transported to Liverpool. And that was really the main point where arms were then being smuggled by mainly Irish sailors and dock workers over to over to Dublin. So yeah, arms would have been gathered across England and then funneled towards Liverpool. And from there, they were being smuggled on various boats that were travelling from London to different parts of Ireland.
I asked Sam how big these shipments of weapons were. We often think of gun running involving tens of thousands of guns. But as he now explains, it wasn't on this scale at all.
No, I mean, it is small scale. I think the other thing that, you know, should be mentioned is that a lot of the times these leads were dead ends. You know, people would be given money to, say, shady, crooked arms dealers, and then nothing would be coming back. So I think so much time was spent chasing up contacts and deals. I mean, the amount of time wasted was considerable. But yeah, the quantities were quite small. You know, we're talking about a dozen rifles or a dozen handguns, you know, maybe in a purchase, or, you know, a couple of thousand rounds of ammunition. Certainly in London, I think they're able to get larger quantities because they have better contacts with soldiers based in different barracks around London. I think it seems to be in Manchester, it's kind of more, slightly more small scale. I think the contacts, certainly in London, places like Woolwich Arsenal are better in terms of where, you know, arms are being held and manufactured. Same in Birmingham, and they seem to have reasonably good contacts where the manufacture of arms is being taken place.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Up to this point, we've discussed what might be described as support work for the IRA in Ireland. I asked Sam about the armed campaign which the IRA in Britain undertook in that country.
Yeah, they certainly did. And it didn't last that long, really, when you look back. Obviously, the War of Independence starts in January 1919, but it's not until November 1920 when IRA units start launching attacks across England, particularly Liverpool, particularly Manchester and London. As I mentioned earlier, Birmingham had an active IRA company, but they were basically told that because it was such an important city for arms manufacturing, that there's little point in trying to draw attention to yourselves with actual operations. So the Birmingham IRA were told just focus on smuggling. IRA units in Scotland and Wales were also told by GHQ not to launch armed operations there. It was essentially England where those armed operations were taking place. And as I said, it was Liverpool, Manchester and London.
The most audacious plans were developed in August 1920, as Sam now explains.
In August and September 1920, there's proposals made by GHQ in Dublin to launch some quite audacious attacks in Britain. There were plans to launch sabotage operations on the Stewart Street Electrical Power Station and Clayton Vale Waterworks, as well as Liverpool Docks. Now, the documents which kind of laid out these plans were captured in Dublin when a safe house where Richard Mackay was staying was raided. So the British government and the authorities had got wind of these planned attacks before they could ever be carried out. However, in November 1920, the IRA still go ahead with a certain operations, specifically on the Liverpool Docks, where there's a wide coordinated attack, an arson attack on the Liverpool docks. So it does go ahead to some degree, but not to the, I guess, quite large scale plans that had originally been organised by the IRA.
Now, in two episodes' time, we will look at the events on the Liverpool docks in more detail, which, along with other operations, had far-reaching implications. However, as our conversation about the IRA campaign in Britain continued, we returned to the city of Manchester. In the spring of 1921, the IRA in the city launched a major operation, as Sam now explains.
So in Manchester, were small-scale attacks on farms and factories in the end of 1920 and early 1921. But the most important date, certainly in the later stage of the War of Independence in Manchester, is the 2nd of April 1921. This is when there's coordinated arson attacks across the city on cafes, hotels and factories. One police officer is shot and wounded. And in a response later that evening, the authorities raid one of the Irish halls. And this is one that was on Erskine Street and Hume. There's a shootout with the armed police at this Irish hall where a large number of Irish Republicans were gathered. One IRA volunteer by the name of Sean Morgan is shot and killed. A second IRA member, Sean Wickham, was seriously wounded. And three police officers are slightly injured during this raid. And the police find quite a large cache of arms, ammunition and explosives that were stored in this Irish hall. And 16 men were arrested. There were further raids the following month in which more arms were captured from the IRA. And then in July 1921, those 16 men are brought to trial and they're sentenced to a total of 121 years in total.
Given how active they were, I asked Sam if he could give me a sense of the size and scale of the Republican movement in Manchester.
We know that there was at least four Irish halls across Manchester, at least three of whom were directly ran by the Gaelic League, possibly four. So this is where Ceilidhs would be held, meetings, Irish language classes, and certainly for a couple of them, there were also arms dumps for the IRA and places where IRA members would drill. So, you know, four halls is, you know, it's quite substantial for a relatively small city like Manchester. In terms of Cumann na mBan, as I mentioned, at its height, that four branches across Manchester. By the Irish Self-Determination League, its Manchester branches had roughly 4,000 members, as Gerard Noonan has described in his book, Ireland, the Republican Movement in England. In terms of the IRA itself, there was two Manchester-based companies and one company based in Rochdale. They comprised the Manchester Battalion. From the pensions applications and the membership roles, as well as the applications for service medals, reckon there were about 100 active members of the IRA in Manchester at its height, which might not seem like a lot, but you know, the applicants stress in many ways that, you know, not everybody who walked off the street could, you know, join the IRA. There was certainly a process where individuals would have to vouch for others. That would certainly help their process. And if you were from the same town or village as somebody and you could vouch for them. But also there was a vetting process. And in many cases, what the IRA would try to do, certainly they would get the name of, say, John Smith from Tadavna in Monaghan. They would contact GHQ in Dublin saying, you know, John Smith has applied for membership. And then GHQ would then go to the local IRA officers in Monaghan or to Tadavna, for this example, and try to confirm the credentials of this particular person. So, yeah, the IRA might seemingly have been small in Manchester with only 100 people. But first of all, these were 100 people who would have taken place in active operations. You know, there might have been another layer of people who would have been doing support work. And as I said, secondly, they were not letting in anybody. So they were trying to keep the organization small in terms of people who they trusted and people who were also willing to take part in the operations that the IRA were going to be involved in at the time.
Given everything we had talked about, I was curious how the IRA in Britain fitted into the structure of the broader organization, which was directed from the general headquarters based in Dublin.
The higher IRA officers, you know, particularly on a battalion level, whether it's Liverpool Battalion or Manchester or London, would have had, you know, quite good and regular contact with GHQ. You know, before the armed campaign in England begins, there are some parameters set out. As I've mentioned earlier, you know, operations were only going to take place in England, not Scotland or Wales. There seems to be also an order that large employers of Irish workers are not targeted. So essentially that if a large group of Irish emigrants were working in a particular factory, those factories should not be targeted because as a result of that, that could lead to a large number of Irish people being unemployed. Now, certainly factories and mills were attacked in Manchester and other cities, you know, in late 1920 to 1921. So not too sure whether those orders were directly maintained. So I'm not sure with those orders adhered to later on, but certainly at the initial start of the campaign, there were some parameters laid out. You know, Rory O'Connor was OC England. Certainly he was coming over to England as much as he could to visit the IRA units and inspect plans. But I think on a day-to-day week-to-week level, there was some autonomy given to the units in Manchester and other cities, you know, in terms of picking the exact targets, picking which men were going to go on operations. You know, they would have to do that on their own and on their own initiative.
As our discussion turned to some of the unique problems faced by the Republican movement in Britain, Sam talked about something which I found strange and surprising. Even though they were involved in activity that could land them in prison, what were often petty and trivial rivalries from Ireland divided the IRA, in London in particular.
Certainly this seems to be a problem in London, where within the IRA, because you're different men from different counties, perhaps naturally they would be socialising with each other. But probably more than that, there was some rivalry. And it's Reggie Dunn, who was a high-ranking London IRA officer who was later executed for his role in the assassination of Sir Henry Wilson. He writes during the truce period that the men from each county hang around like Freemasons. Cork men think they're men of their city and county have won the war. And he'd go on to say, well, the Kerry men would think that their guys are the best, and so on. So, yeah, certainly in London, there's not examples of this in Manchester, but certainly in London, there is rivalry between the different county guys. And more than that, though, there seems to be another kind of division between the English-born IRA members and the Irish-born IRA members who had come over for work. So you kind of have two degrees of, I guess, rivalry. So the Cork guys would be hanging around with the Cork guys, the Kerry guys with the Kerry guys, but then they may also look with some suspicion or some distrust, or maybe wouldn't look quite as fondly over the guys with the English accents, like Reggie Dunn and others, who, you know, just by the fact that their parents moved over to Ireland in previous years, happened to be born there and happened to be having an English accent.
While we'd discussed a lot of their activities, I was eager to ask Sam what the aim and strategy of the IRA was in Britain. The buildings and installations they targeted affected the people they worked with and the communities they lived in. Were they trying to punish the British population or, alternatively, force the hand of British politicians? Now, Sam's answer here was fascinating.
I think that's a really good question. I think, you know, it's hard to quantify, but my point of view, I'd argue that those who'd moved over to England in the year or 2 years before the War of Independence, because they'd left links with those cities like Manchester, I'm guessing they're probably more up for the armed campaign in many ways. They probably didn't have as many issues with the idea of going out and launching arson attacks on factories and mills, and in two instances, it was football grounds. You know, having said that, no, I don't know if there's any evidence that the Manchester-born IRA men, for this example, were more hesitant. But I can only imagine that if you had gone to school or worked in Manchester for many years, you may be more hesitant to a certain degree, or certainly would be more worried about the public reaction of your friends and your neighbours and your work colleagues, because you've more to lose, I guess, essentially. I think that's a very important point to always reiterate when we're talking about the IRA in England, is that they couldn't rely on the support, passive or direct support, of their colleagues or their workmates or their neighbours. You know, they were really isolated, both on a wide scale of the English population not being supportive of their campaign, but also a layer of the Irish population not being supportive of their campaign either. I think in terms of the logic or the reason for the IRA campaign was probably twofold. It was, first of all, it was publicity. You know, first and foremost, they wanted to draw attention to what was going on in Ireland. And, you know, one of the best ways of doing that was to, you know, have something spectacular like an attack on a farm or attack on a building and directly say that we were doing this because of what was going on in Ireland. You know, if you were reading a newspaper in Manchester, you couldn't avoid that if you were, you know, an English-born person. If there's activity in your own city, that's going to draw attention to the Irish cause, perhaps more than something that was going on in Ireland. You know, as well as just general publicity seeking, I think there was a genuine sense from IRA members very personally that they wanted to revenge the atrocities and the attacks that were being carried out by, you know, the Black and Tans and others in Ireland, especially after events like the sacking of Balbriggan in September 1920. I think there was a sense of, we want to do to England what is being done back home in Ireland.
This led us on to the reaction of the wider British public at the time. Sam detailed the experience of one woman involved in the movement, which was very revealing.
it comes across now and again in the pension applications and other sources. One particular woman called Peg Buckley, she's originally from Macroom in Cork. She moves over to Manchester for employment. She's active in Cumannamon from 1918 onwards. And during the War of Independence, she plays an important role in transporting arms. And when she's writing in to the pensions board to support her application, you know, you're talking 20, 30 years after the events, you can see that, you know, what had happened back then certainly resonated with her many years later. And this is a quote from her pension application. "I took parcels of arms and ammunition from fellows of the American boats. My home at 9 Lady Byron Avenue was used as a storing place. I had to distribute the same to other houses on several occasions. Taking the risk of carrying large suitcases along crowded thoroughfares and on streetcars. My house was raided on one occasion by 4 detectives. Some small guns hidden there were not discovered. My neighbours became very hostile to us after this event." I think the two things that jump out there was just the absolute stress that would be on someone's conscience and on someone's, you know, activity of having to carry large suitcases of arms through crowded streets and on public transport. I mean, you can imagine just a person sweating going through that with fear of being caught. But then she ends that quote by just talking about how a raid that occurred on her home that led to her neighbours, presumably English neighbours, become very hostile to us. So again, that's an impact on her life from being involved coming on.
There was incidents, however, where some British workers were sympathetic to the Irish cause.
Yeah, there's some cases. One of the most interesting involves trade unionists and workers in Manchester. And this comes through the pension application of Gilbert Lynch, who was a very well-known trade unionist in Manchester as someone who had fought in the 1916 Rising. It's through his contacts with left-wing trade unionists, particularly in a factory of the Crossley Motor Company, who were manufacturing and also repairing Crossley tenders for use by the British forces in Ireland. He says in his pension application that he was able to get some of them to sabotage these tenders that were being repaired. And as a result, that would certainly held up work. And he's, I think, certainly suggesting, reading between the lines, that these were not necessarily Irish factory workers, but those who had some sympathy to the Irish cause because they were socialists and trade unionists.
Now, to conclude the interview, I asked Sam to give me an overview of the IRA campaign in Britain towards the end of the conflict.
I mean, from a Manchester IRA perspective, as I said, there was the raids in April and May 21, which leads to a large number being arrested. Many of those who don't get caught then simply flee the city. So some go to different parts of England, some travel back to Ireland. Those 60 men who had been arrested, their sentence in July 21. Luckily for them, they come out during the truce in February 1922. I think the truce is an interesting time because it comes true in London that there was a lot of these IRA guys who had lost their jobs, who had lost a sense of purpose directly. Essentially, they were looking for more funds from GHQ to help support them. There was kind of guys who, like in Ireland, just had, you know, maybe less to live for now that the truce had been called. Some of them were drinking too much. Some of them were getting into fights. Even though the truce had been declared, the arms smuggling was still going on because there was obviously a possibility that the war would be resumed. And in London, the GHQ chemical department continued their plans to manufacture explosives. And it's actually during the truce period, which, you know, many people will see as the quiet time, and it was in many ways, in which that's the only fatality of the London IRA is actually in the truce period when one of its members is killed accidentally when manufacturing explosives. And the plans that the London IRA had for those explosives is quite staggering. William Ahern, an IRA officer, has written in his application that the explosives were going to be used for the blowing up of powerhouses, sewers, underground cable junctions, underground railways. And the way they were going to utilise these explosives was quite interesting as well. He said that he had been given instructions to buy 6 old lorries, which were then going to be lined with steel and concrete and filled with explosives. So in many ways, these were kind of early car bombs. And it's quite interesting to hear that the IRA in London particularly had these quite audacious and quite big plans to launch a bombing campaign if the truce and negotiations fell through and if war was going to be resumed.
I want to thank Sam not only for his time in this interview, but also his ongoing work in the series. Next week is that exclusive Q&A with Dr. Brian Hanley, only available on Patreon and Acast Plus. You can sign up at the links in the show notes below. I hope you can join me and Brian for that. Until then, Sloane.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.